Hello and welcome to this Elections 2024 special with me, Peter Bruce, and my guest, former DA leader, brilliant author, speaker and columnist, and now negotiator, Tony Leon. That was quite an election. The ANC, imperious ruler of almost all of it surveyed for 30 years, was simply blown out of the water by Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto we Sizwe party. Last Wednesday, the ANC got just over 40% of the vote, completely lost KZN, lost Gauteng, lost the Northern Cape, never had a chance in the Western Cape. Of its opponents, Zuma's MK took almost 15% of the national vote and 45.3%, just astonishing, in KwaZulu-Natal. It pummeled Julius Malema's EFF into fourth place nationally. I thought Gayton McKenzie's Patriotic Alliance did well to get five MPs from scratch, where after years of bluster, Herman Mashaba's Action SA managed only 1.2% of the vote and just four MPs. That's just two ahead of Songezo Zibi's Rise Mzansi and Musi Maimane's Boso, which each got two. Antonio Leon, the Democratic Alliance not only held on to the Western Cape comfortably for the moment, but it's still the official opposition, taking 21.81% of the vote and three more MPs than before. I wonder, though, whether they'll really be pleased about that. You were on a committee that recommended back in 2019, after the election, that Musi Maimane be fired after the party slipped from the 22.23% Helen Zille got when she was still DA leader in 2014 to 20.77. John Steenhuisen has only partially, marginally recovered from that. Is it good enough? Does he get fired too?
Well, Peter, good afternoon, and nice to talk to you in these momentous days that we're going through. But just to answer your question, look, there's a lot of historical revisionism about that so-called report dealing with Musi Maimane 5 years ago. Musi wasn't fired because the DA went backwards by 400,000 votes, which of course is a very bad indictment of the collective leadership, and it wasn't just him, it was the collective leadership that was identified as being problematic, but because it was a symptom, not the cause of what was a leadership problem. And that was, and it's all in that report. I don't want to reprise it now and here, it's ancient history. But it wasn't because the party had just lost votes. Why did the party lose votes? Why was the party at sixes and sevens with itself? Why was there so much infighting? Why were there so many centers of dysfunctionality in the DA? And we had to conclude that the leadership, and the leader in particular, required refreshing, because if they continued as they were then there would be serious problems down the line. So, you know, you can say that DA's current performance is, I think, to be correct without being over-optimistic. It's solid rather than spectacular, but it's not backwards. You have to say that if the DA had continued on its previous path without making some course corrections, then I think it would not have been a 21%. It might have been a 12% in this election. And also, you know, I don't want it. This is probably not the time to do this, and there are many bigger and far more serious issues now at play. But people said, well, you know, Musi brought a huge amount to the party. Well, you know, on his own, he's worth 0.4% of the national vote. I think this election, in many ways, wasn't just humbling for the ANC. It was humbling for a lot of people and cults, if you like, and causes and parties who thought, well, all I have to do is free myself from the shackles of my current or previous political identity, and I'm going to soar into the universe, with the singular exception, as you identified, of Jacob Zuma. That's not really applicable.
Yeah. But just, you know, okay, let's talk about it differently then. I mean, stay with the DA for a moment. What do you think it wanted from this election, and do you think it got it?
Well, it certainly, look, it was a non-negotiable for the party, and we would be having a very different conversation now if it had not retained control of the Western Cape, and it certainly did that. It certainly wanted to expand its footprint, and it did that, although we could say not as much as it should have, or wanted to. It also, you know, I think one of the misunderstandings about the DA, because it gets this label on its head, it's the white party, which is a convenient, if not lazy, shorthand, is to actually look at the election results in places like Khayelitsha and Soweto and Alexandra and say, well, what did the DA do there? And although it's a very modest precedent, it actually in some, most of those polling stations doubled its support from 5 years ago, although it didn't have a black leader at the helm. And I, when I say the white party, as you know, Peter, the white population, and certainly the white voting population, is an ever-shrinking percentage of the total.
Yeah. No, you don't get 20%.
You know, when I was the leader of, exactly, you don't get 20% by being white, no, or even white Indian and coloured. No. You've got to have some addition to that. So just for the DA to stand still, given, you know, the labelling and the history of this country, is no mean achievement. To even expand in a difficult and contested market is to its credit. But of course, you know, The Economist put it, there was an open goal in front of it and it didn't get the ball in. And that's fair comment. But I think over time, but from a position of solidity and relative strength, the DA is going to have to, you know, go and look at things and see what is the next step. But we don't know what the next step is because we don't know who's going to form the next government. And that also, one way or another, could have a huge impact on the fortunes and misfortunes of that and many other parties that are going to be in consideration for the next few days and weeks.
There's a lot riding, obviously, on what happens in the next couple of weeks. But it does seem to me that the DA has been really overly defensive, you know, and a bit risk averse. I mean, there's so much low-hanging fruit out there, given the state of the country and the complete incompetence of the government. You would have thought they could have done better, and they haven't. That's just a fact. I mean, they've gone up a percentage point.
Look, Peter, I am not the spokesman for the DA, and they've got to be robust enough to defend themselves. But I would say this, and you know, I'm a huge admirer of your columns. But there was, the media and the columnists I respect. I'm not talking about the, you know, the Iqbal survey media. I mean, the proper media in this country, of which you are a stand-up example. You know, it tended to do what happened to the DP in 1994. I mean, if you go back to 1994, most of the newspapers supported the Democratic Party, which got 1.7% of the vote. But it was the National Party tortoise that scooped up the opposition support in South Africa, not the heirs like the Democratic Party. And I couldn't help but think in this election that there were people who had this sort of, in the media, love affair with people like Songeza Zibi Orati, who was an ex-editor, and he seemed to be a fresh face. But, you know, the DA got very little love from the punditry and the commentators. So that was also part of the environment they were navigating. Now, you can say, okay, they didn't deserve it. Well, I often think that party, a bit like King Lear, is more sinned against than sinning. But then you could say that. I would say that, wouldn't I?
Yeah. Yeah. It got, you know, it got a fair amount of space. I did my longest ever podcast with the head of policy on the DA about a month ago or 3 weeks ago. And there was lots of space in the Sunday Times, I remember, for the party. Not, you know, not quite what the ANC was given, but nonetheless. Anyway, so generally, Tony, what did you think of the election? I mean, you know, I ask you that question, I mean, didn't the Social Research Foundation and Victory Research and Gareth van Onselen do brilliantly? I mean, looking back at the first poll that came out from Victory Research via the Social Research Foundation, there the ANC at 42% back last October. It's just extraordinary how accurate it turned out to be.
The polling was extraordinary. I mean, given it's much more difficult to conduct a poll in South Africa because of, you know, where our population is spread about and communications issues and deep rural pockets of folk and so on, than it is, say, in Britain and the United States. But yet the polling here was far more accurate and predictive than the polling was, you know, for the Brexit referendum or even for Trump's first election in 2016, where the polls got it wrong. So I absolutely agree. And even Ian, you know, apart, I thought Gareth and Victory and SRF and Brenthurst were great. But even ENCA, which was completely excoriated when its latest poll said, well, the ANC is coming third or fourth in KZN in the teens. I think they had them down about 13%. They were closer to the money than a lot of pundits who just dismissed it based on speculation. I mean, I couldn't believe some people, some very smart people, who said, well, I don't understand polling, but this poll is completely wrong. Well, you know, based on what were they saying that? And so not only were the pollsters right overwhelmingly, they stuck to their guns and they did an immense amount of public service. So I think that's the first thing. If I could say something, and I'm saying this as a direct, not witness, but participant, I was did humble polling station duty for my old party at the Alphen Centre and Constantia on election day. I tell you, I was very pleased I wasn't a candidate for public office this time. I would have had a heart attack or another one if I'd been a candidate and I'd seen the dog's dinner that the IEC presided over. And that was really across the country. It was terrible. The disorganization, the lack of training of IEC presiding officers, the breakdown of the machinery, the lack of what I could call devolved decision-making. So people who were meant to be running polling stations didn't have the authorization or felt they didn't to make on-the-spot decisions which would have eased the queue. So, I mean, and just, you know, I don't want to go on about this, but in a tightly fought election, you don't want to give fodder to people like Jacob Zuma and the anti-constitutionalists, you know, to say the thing was rigged. I don't think the IEC is capable of rigging an election, but I have to say that we've got to do better. And to sit back on this sort of miasma of self-congratulation of what a world-class, it wasn't world-class, it was very bad. And the reason, it's not just voter disaffection, although I think that's the reason we had a 58% poll, which itself is pretty alarming, has something, not entirely, to do with the disorganization at the point of voting. Or points of
it. It would have, but I mean, the poll was going to be lower anyway. And it was so interesting, you know, we were so invested in it being bigger because it's so exciting, et cetera, that we just assumed that the queues were because there'd been this huge turnout. And it wasn't the case at all. Look, I have to say, the polling station that I went to in Stanford in the Western Cape was absolutely fine. Not a problem. I was in and out in a jiff.
Well, I think it varied from place to place. But, you know, I don't think any South African, whether they're in Kraaifontein or Khayelitsha, should have to stand for 5 or 6 hours in order to cast their democratic vote. And as someone was saying who was much more involved in the election than I was, you shouldn't actually, you know, the IEC shouldn't be amazed when voters rock up on election day to cast a vote. That's what their job is.
Do we...
It seemed to catch quite a few officials by amazement that there were a line of people waiting to come in and vote. What were they expecting?
I mean, does this trigger another conversation about our electoral system? The Minister of Home Affairs has run off with this very silly committee looking into possible changes to the electoral system. It's packed with, you know, ANC worthies and perhaps, you know, that can be in the negotiations over the coming weeks, that can be revisited, we've got to introduce a constituency system surely in some way into this country, just for some accountability, and also so that we kind of almost, you know, so that we know where we are. If you look at the UK, constituencies are the basis of so much research and policy and opinion. It's lovely, you know. Everybody knows, everybody identifies with where they are. In this country, it's not possible.
I completely agree with you. I think we've got to go back. They got a report, Fanzel Slubbert did it, I don't know, 20-plus years ago. They should, and that was staunchly resisted. Of course, I agree, you know, now that that we don't have an automatic ANC majority and certainly not an automatic ANC veto on anything now going forward, It might be added to a laundry list of things to be looked at and reviewed. Yeah, good idea.
Generally, though, the election, and apart from the officiating, what stood out for you besides, you know, obviously the result is quite spectacular, but what did you think of the campaigning generally? When will the DA fill a stadium?
Yes, the TA didn't fill any big stadiums, and they did far better than those who did fill stadiums, such as the EFF. I think that people, there's been a humbling of the pundits who made certain predictions that weren't borne out by the actual results or even the polling before the results. There's obviously been a humbling by the ANC, although I have to say, I think actually the ANC might have done much better if they'd behaved during the election campaign as well as they've behaved since the campaign ended and the results were announced.
They've been quite good, haven't they?
I was hugely impressed with both on the same day, Mr. Mbalula and President Ramaphosa, you know, on Sunday, where they didn't try and gainsay the results. No. They didn't say it was rigged. They didn't say we won't accept it. They didn't say, you know, everyone's wrong and we're right. It was actually, I thought, statesmanlike, I have to say.
Yeah.
Whereas you called it right. I mean, you know, these populist last gasp of efforts by Ramaphosa, you know, on the NHI, which backfired on all accounts, according to Victory Research. The ANC started going down from the moment he announced that, because a lot of middle class folk, black, white, and coloured, started thinking, "Well, I'm going to lose my medical aid here."
Yeah.
You know, and then this kind of imperiousness, you know, that you know, you'll vote for us because we are the ruling party, and we'll give you a T-shirt. I mean, that kind of from a, you know, 4 million rand to Mercedes Benz or whatever Fikile was doing. Those things did not help them, and maybe you know, next time around they will course correct. The ANC says it's capable of correction and self reflection, and maybe it'll be a better country and a better parliament and a better government as a result of that.
Do you think Ramaphosa survives?
Well, I can't imagine a situation in which you're going to have even the modicum of stable government if he doesn't survive. That's just my thinking. I have no basis for saying this other than he really doesn't seem to have, and I'm talking about the country as a whole. I'm not talking about the inner machinations of the ANC NEC, about which I'm, you know, woefully ignorant or blissfully ignorant. I don't know how they reach their decisions, but, you know, I do have a feeling, I think, for after 3 years, you know, what the broad South African opinion is. And, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa, warts and all, is a country mile better than anyone else that is in a credible position to challenge him from within the ANC. Also, however difficult, now, I once again don't want to comment on this, it might be for the ANC to get a majority in Parliament in 2 weeks' time to elect a president, they have a much better chance of doing it with Ramaphosa at the helm than with anyone else at the helm. Unless, of course, their intention is to get the MK to support them, in which case they might do better to ditch him, because apparently the MK requirement is no Ramaphosa. But you can just think of what's going to happen to the country if, for example, and here I can mention this because it's completely outside any brief I might have in the next few days, if the country, you know, puts up an ANC presidential candidate other than Ramaphosa, who is backed by Umkhonto Wesizwe. Well, Peter, you pointed out what the currency markets and the bond markets and, you know, the investments the community is going to do in that event. It'll be an absolute bloodbath.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Financially and economically and perhaps in other respects as well.
I think the yield, this is a complicated way to describe something, but I mean the yield on our 20-year bonds is now about almost 13%, which is beginning to look like Greece 10 years ago when it was going into its financial crisis. So, Tony, look, I know you're in sort of invidious position because DA party leader John Steenhuisen has asked you to join this committee, and this committee that you're going to be part of will formulate a position for possible coalition or whatever arrangement they are in the next couple of weeks, and two, do the meeting with other groups, I presume. And I do remember your former colleague sadly passed away last month, James Self, telling somebody, I'm not sure, I think it was a book I read just before the last election, 2019, the last thing you want to do during coalition discussions is tell the public anything. But perhaps we can talk, if not about the content of those discussions, about the structure of them, just to help people understand what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. All the main parties are going to map out their positions, I suppose. But that's just your position. And somebody, you know, like all plans, somebody smacks you in the face and your plan goes out the window. What's going to happen next? What happens in the next week or two?
Well, you know, my understanding, and I can only speak, I mean, I've been asked, as you say, to join the DA negotiating team, and I'm going to Johannesburg to do that tomorrow. So we haven't actually formally met. Obviously, we had some internal chats, but it'll evolve. As I understand it, the DA is going to take a position on what it broadly finds acceptable for itself, its voters, and for the country. And it'll go and see the appetite or lack thereof with the other parties. And obviously the biggest party is still after their result being less than anyone anticipated is the ANC. So they are the anchor of any new government arrangement because they are the 40% party. And the DA is a 21% party, so there's quite a gap between the two. So it's a number two party, and obviously the DA also has a relationship, a long-standing relationship. I mean, it goes back to my time when Mangosuthu Buthelezi and I had something called the Coalition for Change. Well, we didn't change anything in 2004, but maybe that's going to change now because the DA has a close working relationship with the IFP and to a lesser extent with the Freedom Front Plus. So I guess, I haven't seen the formal agenda, there will be or have been and will continue to be discussions with them because they're in the mix. And they've been in the mix because the Freedom Front Plus is in coalitions, the DA in several municipalities, and the IFP in a brace of municipalities in KwaZulu-Natal with the DA. And they are both charter members of this multi-party pact. So they obviously going to have discussions with each other and with the ANC, either jointly or severally, I don't know. And look, I'm just about to write something about it. I can make an obvious point. You know, our negotiations in South Africa for this election of a president, which is all speaker, which is the first order of business, happens, Peter, in 2 weeks' time. But our constitution was not, I mean, it obviously provides, you know, the manner and form of the election, president, before that, the Speaker of Parliament, but it really didn't envisage a situation in which there would be complicated multi-party coalition negotiations. It really isn't built for that. It can accommodate that. So, you know, Germany is a good example, even Israel as another example of countries where coalition governments are the norm, not the exception. They usually have weeks, months sometimes, to put together a coalition. I think the Netherlands took, I don't know, 5 months. Belgium, some of those things, a year. And we've got 2 weeks to put, at least, install a president. And you assume when you vote for a president, there's going to be a broad understanding that in exchange for voting for a president who only has a minority of the seats in parliament, which is Ramaphosa's objective position, that there'll be some other understandings about how the government that he's going to head or hope to head will be formed. But you've got to concentrate this into 2 weeks or less now.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, what does your gut tell you? You know, this talk today, this has been talking on Monday, the talk of a government of national unity, which surely doesn't sound really appealing to me now. I mean, maybe then, back in the day, after, you know, the dawn of democracy. But the ANC could so easily use a government of national unity now to sort of hide away, couldn't it, and to sort of bury its mistakes and save its embarrassment. I mean, you would get sucked into all sorts of things in a government of national unity today.
Well, you know, there's this great historian, Timothy Snyder, wrote this brilliant book called On Tyranny. It's a booklet, really. He starts, first opening line of it is, "History does not repeat, but it does instruct." Rather brilliant opening line of any polemic on politics and democracy. Well, you know, let's be instructed by that old government of national unity where I was very much, you know, parts of the parliaments of those times. And you've got to say that that didn't happen because of any negotiation that happened post-election. It happened at negotiation, a constitutional multi-party talks, which mandated that if you got X percentage, you entered the cabinet. Finished in clause, Jackie Sleeby of blessed memory would have said. There was no, didn't depend on having an agreement. You got 5%, you went into the cabinet. That was it, if you wanted. And in 1997, when after the National Party had exited that government, Nelson Mandela made me an offer for the DP to enter it. And I realized very quickly, it was a generous offer on the face of it, that if the DP, with its 7 seats in Parliament, entered that government of national unity, we would be completely at the mercy of the ANC, because we wouldn't be able to criticize them in public, but we wouldn't be able to necessarily influence decision-making in the cabinet, maybe on the margins. And it was a hopeless, from the party and democratic prospect, personally, it would have been very nice, but I realized this was a bridge too far. So I respectfully and politely declined. But this is a very different situation, because it's not the GNU of old, it's not the Nelson Mandela magnanimous outreach to opposition figures of 1997. It's that you can't form a government unless you have a 50% to elect the president in 2 weeks' time, and unless you have some arrangement, whatever, however loose or tight it might be, to get budgets and legislation through, and not to have a Weimar situation where the government collapses every 6 months. So, yeah, so it's very different, Peter, from then. But let me say about the GNU, I mean, sure, you could say, well, look, any party which gets above 5% goes into this government. That could be an approach. But the problem with that, and here I'm absolutely not speaking to anything that's not being put in the public domain, so I can say this with straightforwardly, and I can only speak because I know the DA position. There might be other people who have a similar position or not. The DA said, we're not going to co-govern or enter into a governing arrangement with two constitutionally delinquent parties. The one is the MK, which actually wants to throw out the constitution, and the other is the EFF, which wants to undermine the constitution, however much little lip service it pays to it. So if, for example, the thinking is, well, bring in everyone above a certain percentage, well, you can do that. But because you've got two parties in who certainly got above 5%, maybe three if you throw the PA into them, I don't think they got 5%. I don't know what the percentage would be on any GNU construction. You're going to exclude the DA automatically if you bring in parties who are going to put the constitutional settlement at risk. And, you know, that's entirely legitimate. I mean, the ANC and the PA, no, PA, the ANC and the MK could form a government, actually. Yes. On their own.
Yeah, they could.
Or the ANC, the EFF, and a few others. That would be, that's quite constitutionally possible, but it's constitutionally very injurious over time, not to mention economically the same.
No,
and I think, quite frankly, for the DA, a party that does stand for constitutionalism, for sensible economics, for rule of law, if they were to cohabit in such an arrangement, they would be putting a bullet through their brain.
And would that apply to a coalition as well? I mean, when people talk about a government of national unity or a coalition, are they the same thing in your mind, or are they different animals?
I think they're broadly the same. Look, I mean, I haven't seen the terms closely defined in the context and times we're in. I mean, I understand a government of national unity is precisely that. It's a government where the executive is shared. Or I suppose you could say, well, it's a government in which the one party has executive power, which would presumably be the ANC, and the other parties, you know, exercise some power in the legislature. But that's not really a government. That's more what they call, I think, in the British term, confidence and supply, where a party sits outside of the executive, but lends support to the government on major matters and on legislation on a case-by-case basis. Both are possible.
I was just going to say, confidence and supply would probably be, I would have thought, best for the minority party, the smaller parties. but not so good for the ANC. In other words, if we're able to come to an arrangement with the DA and let's say an IFP and perhaps Freedom Front Plus and others, where they would let the government govern, but hold it to account much better in Parliament, so you could have a speaker from another party, if not the DA, or you know the chairmanship of the important committees, the SCOPA and minerals and energy, et cetera, et cetera, where so much skullduggery goes on. At some point, the DA is going to have to decide it has to do its country duty, and surely that would be the least injurious to its own future, simply to sort of stand outside and...
Yeah, I'm sure that's going to be contemplated and considered and interrogated very closely in the next few days. So let me not express a view without being, you know, I was once a diplomat for 3 years. So I'm trying to be diplomatic. But, everything, Peter, not just on this, but generally in life, depends on the T's and C's, the terms and conditions. So, you know, it absolutely depends on what the form and the conditions are, whether you're in a full-blown coalition, whether you're in a much looser arrangement such as the one you've described. There's got to be an understanding, an agreement, actually, on what this is going to mean and how matters are going to be dealt with. Let me say, and for the biggest party, which is the ANC, their consideration, without coming down one side or the other, has to be, well, you know, it might be helpful to us, we can have the executive, but does the government really want to be in a position, the executive, where every single piece of legislation they want to pass has to be subject to a debate and a negotiation before it can be passed?
Yeah.
And you know, you can have a confidence supply agreement, absolutely, in some ways, and it has certain advantages and disadvantages you sketched out. But, you know, that only lasts until one of the parties to it says, well, hang on, we don't want this, and we're going to support a vote of no confidence against you. There'll be certain. And then the government comes tumbling down, or the president gets removed. So what I'm trying to say, there's no ideal option. In the situation we're in, there are a range of options. Some of them are less worse than others, but some of them, you know, it's not an ideal, perfect outcome situation where you can say, well, I'm going to take that off the shelf and it's going to be fantastically beneficial to the country.
It's going to be tricky the next 14 days. There'll be a lot of nonsense, a lot of false and fake news out there, I've no doubt. Two things that did amuse me in this election, Tony, and you pointed one of them out, and you can talk to it just briefly if you can, was the fact that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how Cyril Ramaphosa's position on Palestine helped the party and, you know, positioned it well and it was allegedly popular, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you made the point that Gayton McKenzie, who's done very well for himself in this election, actually campaigned in a way for Israel during the whole, and has for the entire war thus far. How's he got away with that?
Well, because, you know, Peter, I mentioned this in a column I wrote, and I'm not saying, let me say this, Karl Marx was correct. I always thought the ANC were good Marxists, and I was anti-Marxist, but you couldn't go to Wits University when I did study political science and not become imbued in Marxism. Well, Marx had a very simple proposition, which he called false consciousness. And he said people's political choices, I'm crudifying, which said, are determined by their economic interests. So people vote their interests. They don't vote for false consciousness. And Gaza is a matter of esoterica as far as, you know, the lived reality of most folk in Cape Town or elsewhere. They're looking at other things primarily. And that's what they vote as you know, whether they vote as coloureds or whether they vote as working class people or poor people or aspirational people, that's probably going to inform their vote more than your position on Gaza versus Israel. But, you know, having said that, there are about seven times more evangelical Christians in South Africa than there are Muslims. And I'm not saying every Muslim is pro-Hamas or anti-Israel, and I'm not saying every evangelical Christian is the reverse of that. I'm definitely not saying that. But evangelicals and Gayton McKenzie's very much of that evangelical Christian approach in politics have a very different approach to, say, Cyril Ramaphosa or Naledi Pandor on Gaza. That much is clear. And, you know, even if you go and look at the voting districts, which have apparently significant concentration of Muslims, I think the results were almost entirely dependent on the class circumstances of people, not on the positions the parties took on foreign policy. I think it was but, you know, frankly, a political science one student could have told the ANC that. So if they were doing this either to repay old debts or in exchange for election contributions or indeed out of innermost conviction, well, that's one thing. But if they were doing it in a cynical calculation, we're going to backfoot the DA on this issue, they made a very bad mistake, yeah, as the results proved.
Yeah. Tony, you're a lawyer. Final question. There's some talk today about whether Jacob Zuma can prevent the election of a president by simply not pitching up to the first sitting of parliament. And that means 58 MPs wouldn't be in the House. Do you know whether that could stop the election of a president? Or, in other words, do 58 MPs prevent a quorum being formed?
Well, I don't know. I must go and look it up. It's I've got the little battered copy of it, very battered, actually. Chapter 4. I must go and look it up. And have you got a copy of the Constitution? I will go.
I do. Chapter 4.
Says Parliament. And?
Well, there's...
Chapter 4.
Yeah, I mean, it's the... You've got to bump around the book a little bit because it takes you into some of the Schedule 2, I think it was. You've got the actual voting. But there is some concern that Zuma may try to spoil the election of a president by, if he doesn't get his way in the next couple of days, by simply not pitching up. On the other hand, other people are saying, well, if he doesn't pitch up, it'll make the presidential election much easier. But it does seem to be a little bit of a point of contention.
I'm sure that I also got the same WhatsApp about this, and I must look at it. I haven't done so yet, and I'm not going to give an ex-cathedra opinion, as I'm very much a detribalized attorney.
But yes.
I can read legal documents.
Yes.
Still, I hope.
John, I think the Deputy Minister of Justice has answered the question in some. He's answered it fairly well. He basically simply said that half the house plus one MP is enough. So I'm sure that won't be that much.
So
of a
that
problem.
Means you basically need 201 people present in Parliament to elect a president.
Yeah. But there'll be, Dali and Porfu will be up before the Constitutional Court ahead of the first sitting. There'll be some effort made, no doubt, to ruin the whole thing. But
well, I'm not going to comment on his success in law. I do confess, I lectured him at Fitz University as a law student, and I need to say, on the record, he was one of the brightest students I've taught.
No, he's a clever guy. Tony,
but I'm not responsible for his advocacy.
Listen, thanks so much for talking to me, Tony Leon. I much appreciate it. And good luck with your negotiations the next while. And as Bongi Mbonambi said to Andre Pollard as he was preparing to take a penalty in the World Cup last year, semi-final, do it for South Africa. And thank you all for listening too. I'll be back next week. The story isn't going away. Bye-bye and keep safe.